Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you're about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by our very own Rebecca Fine, Head of Art Investing at Yield Street, and Giovanna Quattrone, Investment Associate on the art team. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, I'm very excited today. So maybe perhaps to start, Rebecca, you could give us a little bit of a background on your career.
So I have a deep experience in art. I was an art lawyer for about 15 years before I joined Athena Art Finance in 2015. And I was representing some of the most internationally renowned art dealers, art collectors, museums, and foundations. And I was principally focused on risks as they relate to the art trade. So, for example, very focused on authenticity and attribution and title ownership issues relating to artworks.
Very cool. And Giovanna, how about you?
So I have a background in art history and business. And since I've been on the team at Athena, have evaluated billions of dollars worth of art, including valuations, provenance research, all sorts of vetting in relation to our debt business.
Oh, very cool. So maybe, you know, Rebecca, you can walk everyone through, you know, Giovanni mentioned the Athena art business. Maybe you can walk everyone through Athena and also a little bit about the art team.
Sure. So Athena Art Finance is a dedicated specialty lender. We focus on making loans that are secured by artworks. So art is the only collateral for those loans. And we work with art owners of all sorts, a lot of collectors, some trusts where the underlying corpus is relatively illiquid, are comprised of artworks. We work with gallerists and dealers as well. And our real entire business is focused on the valuation and understanding of the value of art. And when we began the business, we developed a proprietary data analytics platform that very much informs our decisions about how we lend against art. We've been in business since 2015, and we have loaned more than $600 million against art. And as Giovanna mentioned, we've evaluated billions of dollars of artworks in that.
Well, that's great. And like as the Athena, you know, business has evolved, right? You all primarily started, you know, on the debt and lending side, but certainly we've expanded now into art equity investing as well, with our third art equity fund having launched just recently. Maybe you could walk everyone through a little bit about that transition and really how some of that experience on the lending side has helped inform you all as investors on the art equity side.
Absolutely. So we, as you know, on Yield Street developed an art investment product that's linked to the underlying loans that I referenced. So we have a product on the platform that allows investors to invest in this portfolio of art loans. Our investors had really insatiable appetite for the art investments. And over the course of more than a year, we developed our core thesis for the art investment, art equity funds, as we call them. And we'll launch the first in November of 2021. And we're super excited about Fund 3. And we were identified some of the best artists in the best collecting categories with really strong CAGRs. We're, you know, poised for really rapid growth over the next 2 to 5 years. So we're really excited about this third fund as well.
And it's really interesting kind of dynamic, right? So, you know, with a background in sort of, you know, art lending, the returns there are a little bit more defined and capped, right? Where the owner of the art, should the art market or of that particular piece really start to accelerate and really appreciate in value, on the debt side, you don't really participate in that. You're kind of just receiving that fixed interest. But in the art side, you certainly get to participate a little bit more in that upside.
No, that's absolutely right. So as a lender, we make a loan that is sort of a variable rate loan. But to your point, we don't participate all in the equity upside. So in fact, it's a terrific vehicle if you happen to own art or you're a collector, because instead of having to go out to friends and family, if you need additional capital, you can obtain a loan against the art. And then when the art appreciates, you really stand to benefit meaningfully, because as we know, art is a terrific investment generally. The art and equity funds allow our investors to participate in all of the upside when art appreciates in value. And so the art debt and the art equity products, we think, really offer our investors opportunities to get exposure to art as an asset class in the way that makes them, you know, the most comfortable. But we're really excited. These are the first diversified art equity funds that are available to accredited investors.
That's great. And, you know, I want to spend some time talking about really why someone wants to consider having art in their portfolio. But Giovanna, maybe to have you jump in here. I think the headlines speak for themselves when you think about the art market and really what happened in 2021. Maybe go walk everyone through a little bit of those details, though.
Yeah, so in 2021, we saw a return to in-person bidding after sale rooms across the globe had shut down for a while. And 2021 was a record year for the auction houses. Sotheby's, Christie's, and Phillips reported a combined $15 billion in sales in 2021. So for Sotheby's, that was a record year in their history of business, in their 277 history year of business. And Phillips reported a $1.2 billion sales year, which was also a record for their business. So overall, we saw a really strong comeback after everything transitioned to online for a little while. And the auction houses attribute this to a surge in global wealth and also a lot of new younger collectors that were never bidding before. I think a lot of these younger collectors, newer collectors, whet their appetite a bit with these online sales during COVID when all the sale rooms were closed. And then when auction sale rooms reopened this past year, all of those new collectors came back for in-person bidding and they were really driving the prices up. So post-war and contemporary art also for the second or third or fourth year in a row was the largest collecting category in the art market. And 2021 represented the best year since 2018. So 2018 was previously the peak for post-war and contemporary art as a collecting category. Now the best year ever has been 2021. So we're really excited to see what happens in sale rooms in 2022.
And for our investors to participate in all of that, art, as we know, is a really great store of wealth. And as people, you know, balance their concerns about the inflation, we think that this is a really terrific way to diversify and, you know, really urge everybody to consider it at any level. Our sort of minimum investment levels are between $10,000 and $15,000. And, you know, a $10,000 investment gives you exposure to a fund of really terrific artworks of, you know, $10 million, $15 million. And the barriers to entry previously for people who are interested in investing in art funds was extremely high, and not only cost prohibitive, but people who frankly don't have a background in art or aren't advised by an art advisor are very loath to get, because the market is opaque and you really do have to rely on experts. to make those kinds of decisions, at least if you're doing so on an informed basis.
Well, I want to circle back on that, because I think a lot of that is kind of what the special sauce is of the investment process here. Mm-hmm. And I think you alluded to some, and Giovanni, I think you did as well, but you know, many believe that art has significant benefits to one's portfolio. Certainly there's the opportunity for some outsized returns, as Giovanna was mentioning, just in terms of the overall growth mm-hmm. and also performance of the art itself. You also start to allude to the diversification benefits and mm-hmm. also the ability to hedge against inflation. Maybe you could expand on those last two and also any other benefits you think art has in a portfolio.
Well, art has traditionally performed really well in inflationary times, and we've seen cycles in 2008 and previously. So we have at Athena been gathering data on the market for the last 6 years, and we have developed a proprietary data analytics platform that informs our decisions about how much to lend against and which artworks really are eligible. And we are very focused on the future saleability of those works, because as lenders, we need to understand how those artworks would perform at some point in the future if, God forbid, there's an event of default and we have to liquidate the artworks. So our core thesis is that we focus on and acquire only the most exceptional examples of an artist's most iconic subject matter from the most important period of their artistic output, because we know from our experience and our analytics that the highest caliber artworks are the ones that eventually perform the best when they're sold. So that very much does inform our investment philosophy in the art funds.
That's great. And so, you know, kind of, you know, jumping into that a little bit more, you know, you've kind of alluded to it throughout the conversation so far, you know, a little bit around, you know, access, and certainly, you know, quite a bit around the kind of data that you all rely on to try to make informed decisions on what artists are performing well, maybe on the cusp of really kind of breaking out.
Right.
Maybe you could walk us a little bit through what sort of sets apart your buy and sell process, particularly around access to the artworks themselves.
Sure. I mean, it's not a surprise to anybody that it is a very relationship-driven business. And we have a very vast network of professionals with whom we work. And we consider it really important that we obtain independent inputs from, you know, art appraisers who don't work for us. So in every instance, when we're identifying an artist we think is suitable for a fund, long before we make any bids or discuss a potential acquisition, we get an independent valuation that we receive from an independent appraiser. And only then do we bid and consummate a transaction with a seller. But we work with, you know, a trusted group of gallerists and dealers. And that's a function of the fact that we really have developed trusted relationships with people. And unfortunately, this is sort of what it takes to be able to get access to the best works. And for example, some of the artists in our fund are really rising stars, and it's very difficult to acquire their works if you don't have the ability to access those channels.
That's great. So you know, you alluded to it, right? And we did at the front of the show as well. Art Equity Fund 3 is open and available and accepting investments. It's our third art equity fund, the previous first and second having launched, I think, in December and January mm-hmm. Of over the last 4 months or so. Giovanna, maybe you could kind of walk everyone through a little bit around what the Art Fund 3's focus will be, and maybe some of the selected artists that will be featured in the fund to start.
Sure. So we are focusing on widely recognizable and also more emerging post-war and contemporary artists. So this fund is post-war and contemporary art all the way. We wanted to have both established artists with you know, an established track record on the secondary market, but also a mix of more emerging artists that we have internally and externally vetted to be kind of on the rise, as Rebecca just mentioned. Artists that are getting picked for important institutional recognition that will be coming up in the form of exhibitions at important museums and galleries over the next few years. And we also wanted to source work with blue chip artists. So Rebecca was talking a moment ago about our data analytics platform. And we use that to show an artist's depth of market over the past 15 or so years. We look at average price trends, what mediums are performing the best, what mediums are the most desirable, how artworks at auction are performing against their low estimates and high estimates. And that's how we base a lot of our decisions.
Yeah, and even just, Giovanna, to your point, I mean, we're looking not only at the prices achieved, but the depth of the bidder pool, how much competition there is when a work is offered, even in some instances, in what markets they perform the best. As we know, auctions happen all over the globe, and certain artists are performing better at certain locations, and we're tracking all of that information that informs all of our decision making. And some of these artists, I just want to point out that all of the artists in the fund have very strong institutional support. That means that museums are acquiring their works globally, and that's very important for us as well.
Well, let's double click on that a little bit, right? So you mentioned the depth of the market, right? Because certainly having one bid at one amount
right.
doesn't necessarily mean that there's a deep market where
exactly.
there's a lot of different bidders that can really support an artist and all their works.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you also talked a lot about, you know, the desire to have these in galleries and museums.
Yep.
Maybe you could expand on why that's so important. And also, you know, are they buying or are they just featuring some of these artists, and how does that dynamic play into it?
Yeah, so I want to come back to both these points, and I want to make a point of reminding Giovanna to talk about one of the more exciting auctions of late involving a Banksy. As a matter of fact, we'll come back to that in 2018. But it is very important to an artwork's value that the work be exhibited, and the provenance of an artwork, where it comes from, the history of ownership also does very much impact an artwork's value and desirability. So we are very keen to have the artworks in our funds loaned to important museums for exhibitions. So for example, in Fund 2, we had a Faith Ringgold narrative quilt that is featured very prominently right now at the New Museum in a really beautiful retrospective of her work. And we have Alice Neal paintings that are going to the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. And we are custodians of these artworks for a period of time, and we feel that it's really important to make that time meaningful. And it certainly enhances the value of the fund artworks when they are exhibited in important venues. So we and very much consider that we would love to be able to share these artworks. Of course, the investors don't know which object belongs to the fund, but it's going to be exciting nonetheless for them to be able to go there and know that they're a part of that legacy and that they have contributed in some way to that exhibition. And I think that's super exciting for our investors.
Yeah, and Giovanna, before we get to some of the artists featured in the fund, I do want to follow up on that point. It's certainly a question we get asked quite often. You know, how come we don't reveal each painting or each piece of art within the fund?
Yes, that's an excellent question. We're asked a lot. We feel strongly that at this point, there isn't widespread acceptance of these kinds of investment funds, and that potentially this would adversely impact the desirability of the artworks when we sell them in the future. We consider that when we lend the artworks, for example, to museums, we lend them on an anonymous basis. And we feel that there are others who disagree, but we have gotten tremendous validation from the people from whom we're sourcing the artwork, who are selling to us. And they're very, very keen to work with us because it's important to them that the prices at which we acquire these works not be published. You think about it, if you're publishing the prices at which you're transacting, you can't get a discount. And it's really an important consideration, because part of what makes us advisors, part of what puts us in a position to help curate these funds is our access and our ability to leverage our network and our relationships in order to acquire the works, the best works, at the best prices. So there are a lot of reasons really why we choose not to do this.
And we're also confident that the caliber of the individual artworks will speak for themselves when we do eventually sell them. And we don't want that to be influenced at all with the connection with an equity fund.
Okay, great. So with that, G, maybe you can start to walk us through some of the artists that will be featured in the fund.
Yeah, so I'll talk about just a couple. I'll start with Takashi Murakami, who is a Japanese contemporary artist. He works across a variety of media, but he's probably most well known for his paintings and sculptures. He is considered a blue chip artist, so he has a very established track record on the secondary market. He's known for his self-titled super flat aesthetic, which is a 2D style that kind of combines the division between fine art and pop culture. And overall, his work brings together the elements of both Japanese subculture and Western art practices, and the very complicated history between both of these influences. So he's constantly blurring the line between fine art and commercial art. One of his most iconic images is probably the smiling flowers. And he does these as both sculptures and also in his paintings and drawings. So sometimes there will be something that is illustrating hundreds of these little smiling flower faces. And the flowers have steadily taken over fashion and pop culture because they embody mass consumption and luxury and pop art all at the same time. And on the surface, the flowers are really happy and cartoon-like because they're all smiling. But if you look really closely in their eyes, there's actually hidden tears, which is a little sad. Something that you might not notice at first glance, but as you spend more time looking at the flowers, you can kind of also see this darkness, I'll say, behind this iconic imagery. And he has received widespread recognition well beyond the art world because he has done many, many, many collaborations with many major brands and also celebrities. So he's probably most well known for his collaboration with Louis Vuitton, which began in 2003. And this partnership lasted over 10 years, which the brand has said is the longest partnership collaboration that they've ever had with another artist. And this partnership in 2003 is really what skyrocketed his art career, because the imagery on the handbag designs that he made in collaboration with Louis Vuitton are also found in a lot of his work. So he's also done collaborations with Kanye West, Kid Cudi, Billie Eilish, Uniqlo, Vans, Supreme, and Louis Vuitton, I already mentioned. And most recently, he participated in a COVID-19 relief effort with the brand Supreme. So in addition to all of these collaborations with these major brands that are known to people even outside of the art world, he also has done many collaborations with landmark cultural institutions, important museums and galleries all over the world. So his work is really known to people globally. And recently, in 2021, he sold his most expensive painting. So we have seen a very steady increase in this artist market over the last 15 years. and the sale of this $5 million painting over the summer at Phillips has really cemented his growth for us.
Giovanna, if I could ask on that, you know, you mentioned quite a bit about this commercial partnership, but also kind of like the exploding or explosive nature of some of his maybe more higher end art concepts. I'm curious, when you all are evaluating artists, how do you kind of weigh the pros and cons of such commercial partnerships?
Oh, we take commercial partnerships really heavily into consideration, because something that a commercial partnership does is get the name of the artist out there and also get some of the artist's imagery out there. So in the case of Takashi Murakami, his flowers have truly become iconic. And maybe you don't regularly visit art museums or galleries, but you've probably seen one of his collaborations with one of the brands or artists that I just mentioned. And we think it's really helpful when an artist is widely recognizable, especially widely recognizable, you know, not just in the US, but globally.
And Peter, we've included links in the offering page as you scroll down to some sort of high level overviews with some imagery, some of which is sort of, you know, comparable to images of works that are contained in the fund. So we encourage investors to really explore those, and you sort of get a sense of what Giovanna is describing so beautifully. But it is difficult to talk about this stuff without seeing the images. So we direct people there and hope that they find that interesting.
And I just wonder, you know, like, you know, to that point, Giovanna and Rebecca, you know, is it fair to say that these commercial partnerships, more than anything else, also bring in a deeper pool of potential investors, because now all of a sudden this is an artist that they know, whereas
Absolutely.
Certain elements of high-end art are just kind of
Absolutely.
Artists maybe that are much
yes.
less well-known?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, very helpful. Giovanna, maybe you could walk through some of the other artists featured in the fund.
Okay, so next I would like to talk about Banksy. Banksy is a British street artist who is completely anonymous. So nobody
Does that
knows.
Remain true?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, cool.
We don't know. Nobody knows. There are people that claim that they know. There are people who claim they have seen him, you know, quickly gathering up his spray paint in an alley after, you know, working on one of his graffiti works. There are a few speculations assigning his identity to other street artists, but to date, we really don't know exactly who this artist is. It's also been speculated that it could be a whole studio, a whole group of artists. It could be a woman, it could be a man. Only time will tell. He is very controversial because he is so mysterious, and his work comments on social injustice and consumerism. So it's a little bit dark and satirical and political. He's mainly working with stencils and spray paint, and the stencils come about because he began basically just doing graffiti in the streets of London. And in order to expedite the process of this illegal activity, it was better for him to use stencils so he could kind of get in and out of the scene of the crime, so to speak, a little more quickly. Some of his iconic imagery includes girl with balloon. It's a little girl who has her hand extended and a balloon has just floated away from her. The flower thrower, he does a lot of rats, monkeys, barcode monkeys. Odds are, maybe you might not recognize the name, but you've probably seen one of these iconic images at some point somewhere. Probably the most iconic event linked to this artist that we have to talk about is the incident of the shredded painting. So in 2018, there was an auction at Sotheby's, and the last lot in the auction was a painting titled Girl with Balloon, So it's the same painting that I just described, where it's a young girl and a balloon has just floated out of her arms. This work is a painting and it's in an artist's frame. This work was installed next to the auctioneer during the auction. And just as the auctioneer hammered down at $1.3 million for this painting, there was a very loud beeping noise and the painting began to self-destruct. The painting, the canvas, started to move down through the bottom of the frame, and on the other side of the frame, shreds of the canvas were coming out. The canvas was literally shredding the artwork. There were audible gasps. I was not at this auction, but I was watching it on my computer at work with my colleagues. We were gasping. We could hear everyone in the sale room gasping. It was so dramatic. There are many videos of this on YouTube, and I would absolutely encourage people to go and watch this. It's just like a minute long. And shortly after, so the Sotheby's employees kind of very quickly grabbed the painting and they kind of hauled it away, and nobody really knew what was going on. You know, is this a publicity stunt? Did Sotheby's do this? Did Banksy do it? Did the owner of the painting do this? And shortly after this happened, Banksy made an Instagram post with the caption, "Going, going, gone." And then he followed up this post with a video of him installing a shredder inside of this frame so that if the painting ever went to auction, he could press a button in his studio or wherever he was, and the painting would self-destruct. So according to the artist, in all of the run-throughs previous, you know, years prior to the auction and all of the run-throughs, the painting completely shredded the whole canvas. But in this instance, only half of the painting was shredded and then the shredder stopped working. So you have the top half of the canvas is intact and the bottom half is just completely in shreds, you know, just hanging from the bottom of the frame. It was very insane and mysterious and nobody knew what was going on. And a few days after, Sotheby's puts out a press release saying that they did not have any knowledge this was going to happen. They weren't involved. They weren't working with Banksy. It was an anonymous seller. And that, in fact, a new artwork by Banksy had been made through this destructive act. They gave it a new name. Now it's called Love is in the Bin, as opposed to Girl with a Balloon. And this was in 2018, the shredding incident. Just last year, in 2021, this same half-shredded painting, Love is in the Bin, was offered at auction, and it resold for a record price, $25.4 million.
I know we can't say you know, much about the individual artworks owned by the fund, but certainly you can say if it's in a frame or not. Is this something that we have to worry about?
So our work is framed, and I don't want anyone to get too excited because obviously here you had a really, really, really tremendous increase in price in just a few years. But yes, our work is framed. Nothing has happened to it that we are aware of. It is safely in a crate. Only time will tell what's going to happen with our work that's in the fund. But this stunt in 2018 and even the resale just last year will go down in art history as one of the only times that a destructive act has led to such an insane increase in price.
Just out of curiosity there, you know, very quickly, if either of you want to jump in on this, do we think that Banksy ultimately was satisfied with this, or do you think that just frustrated him further, knowing that, you know, there's a lot of monetization coming from this act that was maybe meant to kind of destroy a piece that he thought was being kind of bought and sold?
I think he was probably not happy. Rebecca?
I don't think his intent was to destroy it. Yeah. But irrespective of that particular sale, we're tracking, you know, all of his sales and not just one, what we really would consider an outlier. So just so that everybody understands, we're not looking at that, at the price that was achieved last year as any sort of an indicator. The artists in our fund are all market leaders because they have a demonstrated track record of price momentum and strong demand. And as I mentioned earlier, they have released, all of them, really strong institutional support. They're represented by the best galleries to the extent, you know, that they have gallery representation, and the bidding for those artworks is the most active. And that's important. You know, the fund is evolving in nature, and we expect to add another, you know, 2 to 5 artworks as we identify the right opportunities. But right now we have nine artworks by different artists in the fund, and it's true for all of them, certainly.
Yeah, so I just want to mention really quickly, you know, we of course consider this sale last year, $25 million, you know, painting, an outlier. But what was interesting is that, you know, going back to 2006, the artist's average prices were in the hundreds of thousands of dollars range. And then in 2019, so shortly after the, you know, the publicity stunt, yeah, whatever you want to call it, his prices, his average prices are now in the multi-million-dollar range. So maybe he was unhappy that the work wasn't really destroyed, but this definitely marked a turning point in the artist's market, and even other artworks that have remained fully intact and are not destroyed in any way, shape, or form have experienced growth because of this.
So, you know, Giovanni, you mentioned, you know, up front, this concept of blue chip artists, of which I believe both Murakami and Banksy would be considered. Yes. But certainly the fund's going to play, you know, both in the blue chip market, but yep, then also we talked a little bit around this emerging artist type area as well. You know, could either of you just kind of quickly walk through maybe, you know, what makes you all comfortable with some of these emerging artists? And also, you know, how do they tend to perform relative maybe to some of the blue chip?
Giovanni, you want to take this? I mean, briefly?
Yeah.
Giovanni, why don't you address that?
While they are more emerging, they are still represented by very established sellers in the marketplace. So it's, comparatively speaking, they are emerging because they have not yet emerged onto the secondary market with this same track record. And, you know, they're not selling hundreds of paintings at auction. They might just be selling a handful, but they are still selling at auction. And we feel comfortable because of the representation that they have. We feel comfortable looking ahead over the next few years, what kind of institutional recognition they're going to be receiving. And I would say the major difference is price. So the price range that these artists, these more emerging artists are selling in, is lower than the price range of a more established artist.
That said, some of them are, you know, $2 to $3 million. But we're really, I mean, we're drawing on our proprietary quantitative research and sort of data-based methodologies. And then we're leveraging our deep industry connectivity and insider aspect, you know, insider access to inform, you know, our perspective on these artists. We're unearthing mispricings in the auction and dealer markets, and then we're capitalizing on those market inefficiencies. So we're leveraging all that to source the what we consider to be the best artworks from multiple channels. And as I said, even with these emerging artists whose works are very difficult, frankly, to acquire on the primary market, we're negotiating discounts, right? And we're acquiring them for prices that are below independently appraised fair values. And that's really an important aspect of our approach to the selection and identification of artworks and artists.
In most cases, emerging artists do not have the same body of work, meaning they just haven't made the same amount of artwork as these more established artists who have been working for a bit longer. And that also impacts the, you know, difficult, like it's very difficult to source them because there are just less available.
Right.
So that's probably another major difference.
And the fund overall, in terms of strategy, Rebecca, you know, that's it, you know, certainly there are NFTs out there in the market now that a lot of people are talking about. But also, you know, there's different types of mediums, whether it's paintings or, you know, stencils, as we were discussing. What will the fund focus on?
So primarily we're focused on paintings and sculpture in price, in part because we consider there to be a less volatility in those markets. And those are the generally much more mature and established markets for the artists we're talking about. At this point, you know, we are focusing on physical art and not NFTs, but that may come in the future. I think that answers your question, right? I mean, we're focused on mostly paintings and sculptures at this point.
No, that's great. And then just maybe we could walk everyone through a little bit around the logistics. Certainly you mentioned that we've got some artworks that are in crates, but essentially when we purchase a piece of art, mm-hmm. What happens to it?
So we purchase the artwork. First of all, prior to that, right, we're getting kind of values that are not formal use PEP appraisals initially, and then we get context for the price. We negotiate the price, we transact, and then the artworks are sent to a fine art storage facility, generally, unless the artworks are traveling for museum exhibitions. And we are generally making our acquisitions are in the US and sometimes in Europe and the UK primarily. But we are, you know, very much expecting that at this stage, you know, the market's very global. And one of the issues we have is that we absolutely need to have a condition report from a museum conservator prior to making any decisions about acquisition and price. So we're somewhat limited there because we really need to be sure that we're working with trusted kind of fiduciaries and that we're receiving real-time information about the condition of the artwork. And that's sometimes difficult to do for works that are being, you know, reviewed on the other side of the globe.
Can I add one thing, Peter? So we also have our conservators weigh in on the way that the work should be packed prior to traveling. So first they're with the seller, and then once we pay for them, they can be received into our possession. But before anything is moved, we always have an evaluation of the way that it's currently packed, and we run it by our conservator. And if our conservator feels like it needs a crate or it needs a different type of packing in any way, shape, or form, we absolutely listen to the conservator. And so in many cases, we are having custom crates right. being fabricated, especially for the really high value pieces, because we want to make sure that once it's delivered to us, the condition is still as pristine as it was when we were vetting it originally. Once it's received into our storage, we have another condition report conducted just to really make sure that nothing happened to it while it was in transit. And then after that, we get a report, we review it, everything is okay, and then it goes into storage. And unless it's going to be exhibited at a museum, we don't touch it. So it's safe and sound.
Let me add a few things. So of course, everything is insured for the fair market value appraisal as opposed to the purchase price, because again, generally speaking, the fair market value appraisal exceeds the acquisition price. And there's a lot of research that's being done in the background. So we're, just as we did as lenders against art, we're conducting provenance research to understand the ownership history for that work. We want to understand the title that the owner has the authority to pass title to us. We're conducting searches with the Art Loss Register prior to finalizing acquisition to understand that and ensure that the artwork has not been reported as stolen or looted at any time. And then after we make the purchase, we are filing with the Art Loss Register. So we register our ownership interest with the Art Loss Register, and then that way we would receive notifications anytime anyone is searching the database for an artwork that's owned by the fund. So we're doing a great deal of diligence around each individual artwork prior to acquiring it and are applying the same rigorous underwriting kind of methodology that we employ as lenders against art to the artworks that we are acquiring on behalf of our investors for the art equity funds.
No, that's great. And then so, you know, you buy the art, the art's stored, maybe it's going and being exhibited at certain galleries or elsewhere. Really, how do you decide when to sell and when, you know, do you sort of expect to sell based on a normal timeline?
So that's a great question. I think that we expect to be selling in the third and fourth years, we think, but, you know, we are constantly surveying the market to ensure that we're selling at the most, you know, at the most optimal prices. And candidly, you know, we've received offers to purchase artworks that we acquired at substantially higher values than we acquired them already, in part because I think we're so discerning about the works that we ultimately acquire. We're really vetting hundreds and hundreds of artworks, for every fund. And we think that that's the right way to do it. I should add also, I forgot that for any artist that has a catalog raisonné, we are ensuring that the work is included in the artist catalog raisonné, which is like a Bible for all of the artist's artwork. And then to the extent that an artist has a sort of an authentication body that provides certificates of authenticity, we are requiring that each of artwork that we acquire has a accompanying certificate of authenticity. And believe it or not, there are many people who are attempting to sell artworks without those indicia of authenticity or and attribution. So these are all, you know, really important criteria for us. And as far as selling is concerned, you know, it's not the intent to sell right away, but we are fiduciaries and we are aiming to optimize the opportunities for our investors and sort of always have our eyes and ears open. But we're super excited about the fact that already, you know, our investments are attracting attention from
That's
the marketplace.
Great. So Rebecca, Giovanna, any parting thoughts here?
We're just so excited that we have an opportunity to introduce investors to art investment. A lot of our investors are not necessarily people going to museums or walking into galleries. They don't feel comfortable asking for prices. We're really hoping that exposure to the art equity funds and the education that we're hoping to provide makes people excited about art, not only as an investment, which we think is a terrific investment, but also engaging them in ways that bring them joy and making them feel more a part of a marketplace that has traditionally really excluded people. Everyone knows that very wealthy people invest in art, sometimes very heavily, and we want our investors to have the opportunities that only the very, very wealthy have. And we think that, you know, introduction to our art equity funds is a wonderful way for people to, you know, diversify their portfolios, to gain exposure, and to learn about art. And we are really excited about our role in that journey, our investors' journey.
That's amazing. Giovanna, anything from you?
Well said, Rebecca.
Yeah, and I can tell you personally, this means so much to me because I'm like third generation of family of artists and gallerists. And this world, the role that we're playing here is one that I think ultimately is going to make everybody a lot more, feel a lot more invested in the future of what we consider to be a really strong art market.
That's great. And for all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. Rebecca, Giovanna, thank you, of course,
Thanks,
as well.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.